We are back again. This is Jeanette Brown, Editor-in-Chief of Clear Admit. I am here with Clear Admit co-founder Graham Richmond for the next in our ongoing series of the Clear Admit MBA Admissions Podcast. We thank you all for tuning in. Tell your friends. This week's episode is going to focus on the dreaded waitlist. Applicants to any school, be it preschool or Harvard Business School, have probably heard about waitlists and hope that their names come nowhere near them. But the reality is that waitlists play an important role for schools, and they don't necessarily spell doom for applicants. So Graham is going to help explain first and foremost what role the waitlist plays for schools, which is a helpful thing to understand if you've just been placed on the waitlist.
Yeah, so I thanks for having me, Jeanette. I will say that the waitlist is, you know, it's one of these glass half full, glass half half empty kind of scenarios. I think applicants are often prone to thinking of it as, you know, glass half empty. But I would actually suggest that if you make a waitlist, it's mostly a good thing, and we'll delve into that during this podcast. So as to why, like, why does the waitlist exist and how do schools use it? The reason the waitlist exists is mostly to just drive applicants crazy. But the reality is that business schools, you know, have a little bit of a tough task in that they want to build a really fantastic class that has people from all over the world, from every possible industry, and just with a range of kind of personal experiences, because they know that that's what makes, you know, the students make the MBA program to a large extent. And that's not easy. When I worked in admissions at Wharton, you know, we constantly were kind of looking at, okay, what do we got so far in the applicant pool? And, you know, we're reading applications, and it's hard, you know, to kind of know where you're going to end up, because not only do you have to make selections in terms of building the ultimate class, but you have very limited control, because you're going to admit a whole bunch of people, but you don't know who's going to accept your offers. And yes, at schools like Wharton or Harvard, the lion's share of people accept, but not all of them. You know, I think, the best schools can get their yields up into the kind of 90% range, like a Harvard or a Stanford. But it starts to fall pretty rapidly as you move down in the rankings. And so there's a lot of movement, and it's sort of a moving target. You can never quite nail it down. And so the waitlist serves a purpose of giving you this kind of reserves, much in the way that, you know, a baseball team goes into the season with 25 guys on their active roster of players, but they have kind of a reserve of, you know, the folks playing down at AAA, or people that are on their, you know, kind of expanded roster that they can bring in. The wait list serves as a tool by which the schools can kind of mix and match, so that when they start to see admissions results from the candidates, where candidates are telling them yes or no and sending deposits, they can begin to sort of say, oh gosh, you know, we're looking short here. Let's go to the wait list and grab some more folks so that we can fill out this bucket. Like, gosh, you know, we accepted all these people from Japan in the first round and none of them have matriculated. So, you know, let's go to the wait list and pull some people from there. So it does serve a purpose. It's not ideal for the candidate in that it, you know, involves waiting.
More waiting. Yeah.
So I know candidates think it's kind of unfair. They're sort of like, well, the school's told me I had to apply by this date and that they would get me a decision by this date. And a waitlist is not really a decision. It's a postponement of a decision. And so I know candidates can be frustrated by that. But I can tell you, you know, at Wharton, the waitlist was really critical in how we could kind of fine tune the class. So it's definitely a tool that the schools use and need.
I'm not sure of the best order here, but I think next I want to ask you what to do when you've been waitlisted. And how does that depend? Do you automatically remain on the waitlist in hopes that you'll get pulled off? Do you decline because you're pissed off that they don't see how great you are? What are some of the scenarios, and what is your advice?
I mean, I think ideally you go into the admissions process, you know, with a set of schools that you're applying to, and you have a kind of order in which you would prefer to attend them kind of in mind, so that, you know, if you've been admitted to your top choice school or your second choice school and your third choice school waitlists you would politely decline and move on. But if you are waitlisted at a school that's kind of your top choice, and maybe you've been admitted to the school that was your last choice, you know, then you would probably remain on the wait list. I mean, assuming you have the ability to wait. So one thing that I want to stress here is that, you know, as I said, being on the wait list involves waiting. And some people can wait. Some people live, you know, within 100 miles of the school that they're waiting to attend. And some people live, you know, thousands and thousands of miles away, or have other, you know, kind of family restrictions that would make it hard for them to kind of learn at a very late date. I mean, I think for international students, this is something that can be really important, because there's usually, you know, if you're in Pakistan and you're on the wait list at, you know, Kellogg, there's probably a point at which you can't wait anymore, because you won't be able to get your visa cleared in time to come to the school. So now, with that said, schools try to keep that in mind, right? They purposely will keep people on the wait list who, A, have said, I'm happy to wait, B, are maybe local or near enough that showing up on the last, you know, at the last minute is possible. But back to your original question, I would say, yeah, if it's a school that you want to attend and you haven't been admitted to another program that trumps that, you know, that the school in question, then you absolutely would put yourself on the list, you know, or quote, opt in to the wait list. And yeah, and just like sort of see what goes, what happens from there. I mean, there's certain things you can do, and I expect we're going to talk about that momentarily. But you, yeah, you can opt in and start to sort of plot your waitlist strategy, as we would call it here at Clear Admit.
One more thing that we didn't talk about is a way in which the waitlist functions for the school, which is that sometimes there'll be applicants who perhaps have left some doubt in the mind of the admissions committee about how committed they are to a given school, and the waitlist is kind of a litmus test. In those cases, the school wants to see if you say you want to stay on the waitlist, it's a pretty good indicator that you are in fact really interested. I'm not sure I'm actually asking a question, but no, do you agree with that point? And
it's a good topic of discussion. I think there are two things. Yeah, one is like how some schools use the list differently than others. You know, I think at the very, very top end of the kind of MBA universe, schools are using the list mostly as a way to ensure they can build a well-rounded class. So they'll just waitlist folks to provide them with kind of insurance around getting the best possible class together. But there are schools, as you kind of move down in the rankings a bit, who do what you seem to be suggesting, which is, you know, they might waitlist people and see what happens. You know, does the person express interest, or does the person call them up and say, yeah, I don't need to be on the list because I'm heading off to school X that's, you know, maybe more highly ranked or something. And so that allows that school to kind of pass on that candidate in a sense. And there have been a lot of discussions in forums and, you know, behind closed doors in the MBA admissions world about, you know, is that kind of what we would call yield massaging? You know, if you waitlist a ton of people and see who says, oh, me, I really want to come, and then you just admit those people, you'll increase your admissions yield. That is the number of people who you accept who matriculate. And that kind of, as we know, can factor into rankings and make your program look more desirable than maybe it is. So there is some gamesmanship that can be done with the wait list. I would also add that sometimes the wait list is different depending on when you're put onto it. So in the first round, because most schools have multiple rounds of admissions, if you're waitlist early on, that's really what I was referring to earlier, is this kind of insurance policy where the school might be saying, gosh, we don't know yet what we're going to see in the later admissions rounds. So let's take anyone that's like sort of, you know, on the cusp or pretty good, but we're not sure in the first round, and we'll put them on the wait list. And then when the round two applications come in, we'll just throw those people into the pool and look at them alongside that group. And we might realize, oh, gosh, these guys are great, you know, and they were early, and often folks who apply early often are, you know, really gung-ho and qualified. And so they might find that, you know, that having that reserve from the first round is really important, especially if like the second round turns out to be a smaller round than expected. So it's, again, it's kind of an insurance policy. And frankly, your odds of getting in to a business school off the wait list when waitlisted in round one are quite different than your odds of getting into a business school when you're waitlisted in the final round, right? Because there are just fewer and fewer spaces left. You could almost think of being waitlisted in the first round as essentially being like a round two applicant, because you get put into the pool with round two in most cases. Whereas if you're waitlisted in the third round, and which is often the final round, there is no more place for you to go, right? You just have to wait around and see if they don't get enough candidates to matriculate and if they have holes that they need to fill that are highly specific. So it's a little bit different. So the waitlist has, there are a lot of nuances to it.
So talk a little bit about strategies. If you are placed on the waitlist and you have decided that the school where you've been waitlisted is a school that you are really interested in attending, you've said to them, I want to remain on the wait list. What do you do in the weeks and months ahead? What would you advise applicants to do?
So the first piece of advice that I would give is follow instructions. Because some schools, when you opt into the wait list, will tell you, great, we've noted it, and we will be in touch, and don't call us, we'll call you. Don't submit any additional materials. We don't want to make this kind of an arms race of which waitlist candidates can, you know, submit the best additional essays or additional recommendations. And so that's, you know, there are schools that are like that. I mean, Harvard, Wharton, there are a number of them that just don't want to, as they would put it, they don't want to taint the process by letting people start to submit extra stuff. But then there are other schools that have a much more kind of open policy with the waitlist, in which they might even assign you what's called a waitlist manager, who will have a phone call with you and say, gee, you know, we're really happy you applied. These are a couple of the things that we think were weak points in your file, and that should you be able to adjust those, we'd be all ears. You know, maybe it's a low test score, or you know, maybe they want to see some additional leadership at work, or, you know, maybe they need another reference letter. So some schools have a very much more kind of open policy and leave it to the candidate to submit additional materials and to kind of basically begin a little campaign, you know, for their candidacy. So you want to follow instructions, though, because the worst thing on earth that you can do is ignore those instructions. It sends the wrong message to us. So you want to make sure that you follow the instructions. But if a school is open to supplemental materials, then it would really behoove you to take them up on that. And it would be really foolish to just sort of sit there, because they're going to assume that this means, yeah, you put yourself on the list, but you're not really doing anything to help get off the list. So, yeah, so there, and it varies. I mean, there are different things you would do based on what the weaknesses in your candidacy might be. But yeah, people can be quite effective about it. It's almost like an election campaign. You know, they can devise a strategy. I'm going to send a supplemental essay in week one, and then 2 weeks later, I'm going to have a letter of recommendation come from the client that I just worked with, who's going to speak to something that was kind of missing in my file, or, you know, and then I'm going to resit the GMAT exam a month from now, and I'm going to send them a new score that ideally will be better. So there are a whole bunch of things you can do, but you got to, you know, obviously the school has to be willing to hear you on that.
And presumably, if a school is going to the trouble of giving that precise guidance, the thing not to do is ignore it.
Right. So, you know, there are schools that have waitlist managers, like Columbia Business School does that. And if they tell you, gee, we really liked everything in your file and think you could be a terrific fit here, but your test score is a red flag for us. It's just, you know, whether it's your quantitative score on the GMAT or some aspect that is just making them concerned about your academic ability, you know, then if you don't retake the test, you're basically saying to them that it's not important enough for you to kind of heed their guidance. Now, there is a little bit of a critique there. Again, as I spoke earlier about, you know, yield management or kind of massaging the numbers by using the wait list. Sometimes there are complaints, you know, levied around a school that calls people up with a lower test score and says, gosh, you know, you would be a great fit here, would love to admit you, but you got to boost your score. And then the person boosts their score and gets in. So that, you know, sometimes people say, well, that's the school trying to kind of increase the average score for those folks that they accept. But again, I think in many cases, it's a legitimate concern that the school has. They're saying, gosh, you know, our average test score is this, and you're quite below that, and that makes us worried about your ability to kind of survive the first year curriculum or something. So,
which is what the GMAT is designed to
predict.
Test for.
Yeah. So I think if a school gives you advice and tells you where your weaknesses are, and you got to address that. I mean, that's the main thing.
And what about keeping in touch beyond specific points that the school may have addressed? Like, how do you decide you get a promotion at work? Is it time to pick up the phone? You take on a new client? Is then the time to get in touch? It seems like There's probably a pretty fine line, and you could cross it without knowing it.
I mean, I would say you almost never will pick up the phone. You would almost always want to document what you're submitting, not because picking up the phone is inherently a bad thing, but it doesn't, you know, it's not going to be in your file afterwards. I mean, and admissions officers tend to be busy and don't really want to take a random call from a waitlisted candidate who's pleading his or her case. But I think if you've been promoted at work, write a quick paragraph or two and let the committee know, assuming, again, that they're open to communications from waitlisted candidates. I think if you take a test and get a better score, if something material has changed in your candidacy, by all means. I often even recommend, if someone's waitlisted and has a chance to get out to campus, maybe they haven't been before, going to campus, spending a day on campus, meeting with current students, meeting with a faculty member, and just learning more about the program and submitting a kind of letter after that visit to explain all the great things you learned while you're on campus and why you're even more enthusiastic than ever to kind of, you know, join the next year's class. And because doing that signals to the committee that you've come, you're committed to kind of learning more, and you really want to be a part of this community. So it's kind of a nice way to document a visit and to demonstrate that you really are committed, and letting them know that, you know, look, if I'm accepted, I'm coming.
What about calling on members of the school's own committee to kind of go to bat for you? Their own community to go to bat for you. So say you've forged a relationship with the alumni interviewer you met with, or with a student you met on campus. Is it appropriate to ask them to say something on your behalf, or when might it be appropriate or not?
So this is something that, as part of the regular course of admissions, we would call a letter of support, meaning, you know, sometimes candidates have relationships with alums or current students who know them and can submit a kind of informal recommendation letter. And you know, there are rules and guidelines around how you might want to do that. I mean, usually you wouldn't pick someone you just met during the admissions process. It would need to be someone that you worked with before, or you went to college with, or someone that you know in the community and have a longstanding relationship with. And you would get them to put in a word for you about why they think you'd be such a great fit, and how well they know you. And so certainly waitlisted candidates, you know, would absolutely want to rack their brain for any kind of connection they might have to the school, and if that person could kind of go to bat for them. I do think in rare cases, if as a candidate you truly have forged a relationship with a current student or with your alumni interviewer, meaning you've kind of kept in touch and really gotten to know these folks and, you know, have just become friends, it can't hurt to sort of ask them what they think and whether they might be able to put in a word. You have to be careful with this stuff, though, because you don't want it to start feeling like a letter writing campaign. And so I would often say, like, one letter of this sort per waitlisted candidate. Like, you don't really want more than one. And if it does come in, it's got to look unsolicited. So you want it to feel like you just happened to mention to the person in question that you were on the wait list. And when they heard that, they just felt moved to speak out on your behalf and to write a letter to the admissions director that effectively says, gosh, I know Jane is, you know, probably did a terrific job in her application. And the fact that, you know, you've waitlisted her has led me to feel more open about speaking out on her behalf, because clearly you as an admissions committee are sending a signal that, you know, she's qualified and makes, you know, the broad cut. And so now that I'm comfortable that you're interested by having waitlisted her, I want to tell you exactly why she should absolutely be a part of the incoming class. And here's why I think she's going to be a big contributor, et cetera. So, but you don't want it to be, Jane asked me to, you know, to write a letter about her candidacy when she, you know, she told me she was waitlisted and asked if I would be willing to put in a word, right? You don't, it's got to feel genuine and unsolicited.
What about having a contingency plan? How long do you wait to get off the wait list? And do you forego putting a deposit down at a school where you have been accepted? How do you make those decisions?
Yeah, this is where it gets kind of challenging because, as I said earlier, like the being on the wait list involves a lot of waiting. It's aptly named. And waiting can be tricky because you may have other offers. My view on this is that you're going to drop like a couple $100,000 often to go to business school, you know, between tuition, cost of living, and, you know, obviously you're going to forgo wages. So you're about to spend a lot of money. And so the candidates who kind of hem and haw about, oh my gosh, I have to put down a deposit of $1,000 or $2,000 to hold my spot at school A that accepted me while I'm on the wait list at school B, I kind of say, look, this is just part of the cost of like making this massive life decision. And by the way, that money that you might lose if you get into the waitlisted school is going to seem like nothing 10 years from now when you're a graduate of that program. And I know, I mean, obviously some people have legitimate like cash flow issues and can't produce the like $2,000 at the drop of a hat. But I think this would be the time to like, you know, talk to friends and family, like get it together to borrow that money and put down your deposit because you don't want to lose your space at a school that's accepted you. I mean, it would be really foolish to just sit on a wait list and assume that you're going to get into the waitlisted school and walk away in the meantime from an offer. So yeah, unfortunately, that's why these schools have deposits though. I don't feel like the candidate is behaving badly by depositing it at school A that admitted them while being on the wait list at school B. I mean, that's, you know, schools do the same. They're doing the same thing in the opposite sense, right? So they're waitlisting people so they can decide. So in a sense, when you deposit at a school and are on the wait list at another, you're sort of waitlisting the first school and you're just buying that option by depositing. So I think it's a pain, but it's something you just sort of have to do and it's part of the process.
Is there a waitlist stigma once you get to school? Does anyone need to know that you were waitlisted and can you let that go yourself?
There is not a stigma. I don't remember ever like talking to people about whether they were waitlisted or not. You know, once you're in, it's like, you know, there are a couple of things like that in business school. So one is the waitlist. People don't usually talk much about the waitlist once you've been accepted and become a student. Similarly, all the rivalry between MBA programs kind of disappears too. So, you know, people love to fight in the forums about, oh, you know, Harvard's better than Wharton or, you know, Stanford's better than Harvard or whatever debates people want to have. But then like once you get to business school and then you travel and you meet other clubs from these schools or you do events with them, no one cares. You know, they're all great schools and there's a certain like camaraderie and you actually find alumni clubs doing things together. So yeah, the waitlist would be just one of those things that just disappears entirely once you're in. Much in the way that once you've been accepted to a business school, your relationship with the admissions team and the school in general is like completely reversed. You know, the shoe is very much on the other foot when you go to the welcome weekends and these
they're trying to win you over.
Yeah, suddenly like they're wooing you and you know, you can kind of let your hair down a little bit. You don't have to be so nervous and such. So yeah, but I don't think the waitlist has any stigma once you've been admitted.
If you are waitlisted, ClearAdmit does have a waitlist guide that goes into great detail about all of these issues and more, and you might want to check that out.
Yeah, there's even kind of sample correspondence in that guide. And yeah, I don't know of any other kind of really in-depth guide on this subject. It's kind of it's a niche subject, right, being waitlisted for top MBA programs. But yeah, absolutely read our guide. It delves into all the details of what you might do and how to handle things. And even how do you handle when you're waitlisted at a school that has a kind of no communications policy? And is there anything you can do? Because sometimes there might be small things that you could do to move the meter. But yeah, so definitely read that. And I would say, you know, hang out on the site because we have chat rooms and tools like Livewire, where people share their status and share the fact that they've been waitlisted and get comments from people in the community that often can be quite, illuminating in terms of having outsiders look at, oh, here's, you know, I was waitlisted at this school, here are my numbers. And then people can chime in and say, gosh, you know, do you think it was this or that? They can really help you figure out, because once you're waitlisted, the first thing you need to do is look in the mirror and figure out, why might I be waitlisted? Is it, you know, is there something in my file that could have been improved? Did I botch the interview or my essays, you know, did they fall flat? And so, yeah, we often recommend like get someone to read your stuff and look at your file and give you feedback. And you can go to like an admissions consultant for that, or you can go to a, you know, current MBA student, but having feedback, because you do need to understand before you wage your campaign, if a school's allowing you to communicate with them, you need to know like, what am I needing to address? Because not every school that allows for communication has a waitlist manager who's like already told you what's wrong with your file.
Right.
In fact, most of them don't. You know, you're just told. Right. So you're told you're on the waitlist and you have to. You can submit additional materials, but they don't tell you what they're looking for.
Right. And by being able to astutely take stock of your candidacy and see what they're seeing, which is where there might be a deficiency, and address it, you are really making a strong case for yourself.
Right, right. So I would say that's just another thing to keep in mind. And we talk about that at length in the Clear Admit waitlist guide too.
So in closing, waitlist sucks, waiting sucks. It's more waiting on top of waiting. We're sorry that you have to suffer through it, but it is by no means necessarily the end of the road. And there are a lot of ways to strategically manage the waitlist as a waitlisted applicant. Mm-hmm. And Graham's gone over several of them, including play by the rules, know the rules, mm-hmm. and follow them.
Yeah.
And if a school allows for you to build your candidacy while on the waitlist, do so either with direction from the school or from a good look in the mirror or outside counsel.
Yeah, and I would say that, one final thing to keep in mind in the kind of glass half full approach here with the wait list is that we often see candidates who are waitlisted in round one getting into programs at a rate of like 50%, okay? Now, obviously, those who are waitlisted late in the game are getting in at a much lower rate. But if you're waitlisted in the first round, all is not lost. Like, you definitely want to look at that as a glass half full. And the other thing I would say is, even if you're not admitted at all, like you're waitlisted and you stay on the waitlist until the very end, and then they just tell you, look, we don't have any room, sorry. If you reapply, your odds of getting in typically spike, and they're very different than a typical candidate. And you can, engage in a way with the admissions team because you'll be kind of second time around, the next year. And so there's absolutely almost like an advantage in, having been through the process, having been waitlisted. I would almost say there's a little bit of sympathy on the part of the school that can play. And especially if you address whatever it was that may have been wrong in the first application cycle, then, that can go a long way towards just showing the admissions team that, wow, this person's dedicated. They've done basically what we asked or what we had identified that was the weakness. And here they are, stronger, faster, better, in year two. So I think, you want to think of this as a long game. If you're waitlisted in the first round, you've got all season to kind of get yourself in. And even if you don't get in there are implications for a following admission cycle should you choose to reapply.
Really great point. Well, thanks again for joining us, Graham, and we'll look forward to the next session.
Thanks, Jeanette.